Daniel, Chapter 5, the seventh talk in a series on Daniel, was presented by David Crabtree on May 31, 2020, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by David Crabtree and is being made available to you by Gutenberg College. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. Contributions to David Crabtree may be made at www.soundinterp.wordpress.com. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. Handout number 7, Daniel, Chapter 5, accompanies this talk.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Reformation Fellowship, virtual Reformation Fellowship. I have two questions now that came in during the week. I'd like to take a little time to respond to each of those questions before we get started on Chapter 5. Cindy's question was, what other possible ways can we respond when we have done something well? It's pretty clear Yahweh is not a fan of King Nebuchadnezzar's initial response as Nebuchadnezzar surveys his kingdom and praises himself. What response would a godly Nebuchadnezzar have? Ignore his accomplishments, acknowledge them and praise God, not acknowledge them and still praise God? There may be other options I haven't thought of. The first thing I want to say with respect to this is, and I've thought about this with regards to other individuals who show up in the Bible and who do something that God disapproves of, and God punishes them for that thing. Generally speaking, it seems to me that in the Bible, when we see that kind of scenario where an individual does something wrong and God declares some kind of punishment for them, I don't know if this is always the case, but generally speaking, we're to see that as not a slip-up, but rather an act that is representative of that person. I think of something like Ananias and Sapphira in Acts, and they lie about having sold their property and turning all their money over to the community. And they die immediately. God strikes them dead. I really think we're to understand that as not just a one-time slip-up, but rather that was indicative of the kind of people that they were. And I think that's true in this case with Nebuchadnezzar, that this is not a slip-up on Nebuchadnezzar's part. This is the way, when he's sitting there and looking out at all that he's done in Babylon and very impressed with himself, that is the state of his heart. That's not a momentary lapse. Now, with respect to Cindy's question, it seems to me, and this I get this from looking at the prophets primarily, but humility is the most important quality that we can have. And when I say humility, I mean humility first and foremost with respect to our Creator God. That is to say that we recognize that God is the sovereign creator of everything and that we are mere creatures, who owe honor and respect and obedience to the one who created us. That everything we have, everything that we do, every breath we take, every move we make, those are all gifts from God. And we ought not take that for granted. It is the natural tendency for sinful human beings. I did it. If I do something, that's something that I, as an autonomous being with autonomous powers, I pulled that off. Humility, then, is a quality whereby we recognize that sinful tendency in us and genuinely recognize that apart from God, we are powerless. So it is truly the case that everything that we do is God's doing through us. All of our powers are granted by God. All the gifts that we have, even if we can use those gifts consistently, that doesn't mean that it's my power. That's still a gift from God. And those powers ought to be used in submission to God and in the service of God. So that's what Nebuchadnezzar failed to recognize, that he saw his accomplishments as emanating out from him as an autonomous creature. Those are things that he himself did, quite independent of any God. And that's an arrogance that is damnable. Now, having said that, I don't think it really matters how we express that. It doesn't necessarily matter how we express that. I could say, I did this. Or I could say, it's only by the grace of God that I did this. One is more true, that there is a, in a very real sense, there's nothing that I do apart from the grace of God. But how you say it, I don't think it necessarily is a problem. One can say, I did this, and still say that, understanding that it's only as a creature who God bestowed power on that I was able to do that. One could also say, I did that by the grace of God, which is true, but one could say that without really recognizing the truth in that. So either way that it's expressed, I think it could be expressing something good, or it could be expressing something bad, depending on the actual intent of the speaker. But humility is critical, absolutely critical. The second question from Karen Peters: I keep wondering about the word empire and whether to think about it in terms of an individual person such as Nebuchadnezzar, or whether to think of it more in terms of a collective group of people in progressive stages of organization. Maybe it's both. However, in both visions, Nebuchadnezzar, the individual man, is specifically identified as the head of gold and the large tree. I'm not sure how to think about Babylon as a nation or empire in the dreams. Perhaps Nebuchadnezzar, as the supreme leader, represents the collective empire as well as the individual man leading the empire. As God deals with Nebuchadnezzar, so he will deal with man's efforts to organize societies towards Babylon-like empires. I think it's interesting in looking at Daniel that there is, just as Karen points out, there is confusion. There is, I wouldn't say it's confusion, there is a lack of clear distinction between the empire and the emperor. That sometimes they're seen as the same thing and sometimes they're seen as separate things. So I've thought about how can we make sense of that lack of distinction between them, why it is that the line between emperor and empire is sometimes fuzzy. I attribute it to the fact that to a large extent, an empire is an expression of the emperor. The emperor, to a larger extent than anybody else, the emperor puts his stamp on the empire that he's ruling. And so it reflects who he is. So to a large extent, you can talk about the two as being synonymous in many respects. However, no empire is a faithful, completely faithful expression of the emperor. No emperor has complete control over the empire. I remember reading, and I have forgotten which tsar it was, one of the tsars of Russia, the autocrat of all the Russias, I don't remember. There are a whole bunch of titles that went with it that underscored all his power. And in fact, there was one tsar that bragged that if he promised something, he couldn't be held to that promise because then his power wouldn't be absolute. And his power was absolute. But another tsar, I think it was Nicholas I, he said, I write decrees and write decrees, and nothing ever happens. So it is truly the case that even an autocrat, someone who has complete control, can't implement his decrees by himself. He needs an army of state functionaries and the military and that sort of thing in order for the decrees to be implemented. And so this tsar was complaining, I write these decrees and they don't get enacted. That is always, to one degree or another, that is always going to be the case, that an emperor does not have complete control over the empire. There are a lot of other people that have to cooperate with it in order for his decrees to be implemented. So it's just an interesting situation where an emperor is to a large extent, an emperor controls his empire, and the empire comes to reflect the character of the emperor. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, he never has complete control. There's always distance, there's always space between the emperor as a person and the empire. So I think that's why it goes back and forth in Daniel. And what we're going to see is, and we'll see in chapter 6, we'll see an example of an emperor who doesn't have complete control of the empire. So to a certain extent, emperors are victims of empire just like everybody else. And so it's interesting to see God deal with emperors as individuals. Sometimes he'll deal with the whole empire, including the emperor, and sometimes he deals with the emperor quite apart from the empire. So I think that's why the line is kind of fuzzy, because in reality, it's kind of a fuzzy situation. Okay, so those are the two questions that I received during the week. Okay, we're going to look at chapter 5 of Daniel today. And I have been surprised to see how much historians have been able to figure out about the history of these ancient kingdoms, much more than I had thought was available to us. And some of that's been relatively recent. By relatively recent, I mean the last 3 or 4 decades. So if you look at books that were written before that, oftentimes they don't have some of this information. And in my mind, some of this historical background really fills out the picture in the book of Daniel in a way that it would be difficult to fill out otherwise. It just fills in a lot of the questions and the stuff that come up as you're reading through the text. So I am going to take longer than usual this week to talk about the historical background to Daniel chapter 5. It used to be the case that students of the book of Daniel, scholars, thought that it was woefully inaccurate with respect to history. There were just too many glaring mistakes that the author of the book of Daniel made. But as time has gone on, what has been discovered is that the historical situation was more complicated than people had appreciated. And there are more details that have come out that actually support the historicity of the account in Daniel in many respects. There are still questions that remain, but there are a number of instances where the historicity of Daniel was questioned in past times, but with further information that those questions have been resolved and the Daniel account was accurate. And we'll see some of those in what I go through today. I know that it has been fashionable to look at the books of the Old Testament and think that they were written much later than tradition says that they were written. And in many cases, that's because they look at the Old Testament texts and they see lots of what they think are historical errors. But my experience has been, just as someone who's observed this over the last 40 or 50 years, is that over time, it's amazing how many of those mistakes have been resolved, and they aren't really mistakes. So my policy, the policy I've developed, is I take the texts at face value and assume that they are accurate. And even when I can't see how to resolve the issues that arise, but I just figure I'll give them the benefit of the doubt, because there are so many times that they've been vindicated. What happened after the death of Nebuchadnezzar? So in the chapters that we've just looked at, last three chapters, it was all about Nebuchadnezzar. And we saw how God dealt with him as an individual. In chapter 5, we see action that occurs about three decades later, after Nebuchadnezzar is gone, has died and has been buried, and has been gone for about 30 years. So what happened in that period of time between Nebuchadnezzar and the events of chapter 5? Nebuchadnezzar's successors were all very unimpressive. Nebuchadnezzar was very impressive. And I pointed out last week that he became a legend throughout the ancient world for all that he had accomplished, especially his building projects, but also his reign and the empire that he had developed and reigned over. But his successors, not so much. When Nebuchadnezzar died, he was succeeded by his son, Amil-Marduk, who ruled from 562 to 560. Now, he's the one that in the Old Testament, in Kings, is referred to as evil Merodach. I don't know the story of how that came to be the way that it was represented in the old in Kings in English, but apparently that somehow derived out of Amil-Marduk, which is the way it was pronounced in Babylonian. He only ruled for 2 years, and he was, at which time he was killed. There was a coup, and he was killed by his brother-in-law, Nergal-Sir. And Nergal-Sir took power, and he ruled from 560 to 556. So he only rules for 4 years. Then he dies, and his son took power. His son was named Labashi-Marduk. He came to power, but he only reigned for a few months, after which time he was killed as part of a coup. The next king was Nabonidus. He became king in 556, and he reigned until 539, which was the end of the Babylonian empire. Nabonidus was a very religious man. The historians say he was the most pious ruler of Babylon. Very religious. He was devoted to the moon god called Sin. He's devoted to the moon god, which was not the god, the main god of Babylon. The main god of Babylon was Marduk. But he was devoted to another god, and that may explain some of the things that happened during his reign, and I'll talk about that in a little bit. Nabonidus was a Renaissance man. He read widely, studied a lot of different things, including architecture. He also studied archaeology, interestingly, a student of history, but well-read, very cultured, wanted to resurrect Babylonian culture, which went way back. But he was reigned as king in Babylon for only 3 years. And then he went to Tema. Tema was a city in the desert of Saudi Arabia, pretty close to, I didn't check this out to make sure how close, but just looking at the map, pretty close to where Mecca and Medina are now in Saudi Arabia. He went there, and that was a crossroads of trading routes. So it was always an attractive place because there was a lot of money that passed through that area and could be tapped into. So after 3 years of reigning in Babylon, Nabonidus, he goes off and he just settles in Tema. He may have conquered some of the peoples in that area and established order there and Babylonian control. But for 13 years, he lived in Tema. And while he was gone, he turned over control of the government in Babylon to his son, Belshazzar. And it wasn't until the last year of his reign that he left Tema and came back to Babylon, apparently because he knew that Babylon was under threat from the Medes and the Persians. Belshazzar, therefore, was essentially the ruler of Babylon during those 13 years when his father was gone to Tema. It was Babylonian practice to celebrate the New Year's. The king played a key role in the celebration of New Year's. Therefore, they could only celebrate it when the king was present. And we know for 13 years, it was not celebrated. It wasn't celebrated until the last year when Nabonidus came back and they celebrated the New Year. We have quite a bit of information about this, the last year of the Babylonian Empire. The mother of Belshazzar was Nitocris. I don't know how to pronounce these names. Nitocris is what I'll say it is. Nitocris was apparently a daughter of Nebuchadnezzar. It's not clear to me. We know that Nebuchadnezzar married a Median princess. It's not clear to me whether this was that wife or if this is another wife, but it could have been that wife. In any case, Nitocris was the mother of Belshazzar. Nitocris was the daughter of Nebuchadnezzar. So that makes Belshazzar the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar. Nitocris was highly respected and extremely popular, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. Now, a little bit of information about how Nabonidus came to the throne will be helpful here. Nabonidus did not come from royal lineage. And in fact, he brags about that, which is, I was talking to my son Noah about this sort of thing, and he was saying one of the really obvious differences that you see in reading the text from Assyria as opposed to Babylon is the Assyrians' kings bragged about their lineage, their credentials, that they were high born and therefore qualified to be the kings of Assyria. In Babylon, you don't have that same situation. The kings of Babylon they kind of take a certain amount of pride in being low-born and yet rising to such a high position. And Nabonidus fits into that category. So Nabonidus was not high-born, but he was married. One of his wives was the daughter of Nebuchadnezzar. He was apparently a high-ranking official under Nergal-Sharezer and maybe under his son Labashi-Marduk as well. But Nabonidus wasn't particularly ambitious. His son Belshazzar appears to have been extremely ambitious. And Belshazzar was also greedy, wanted to do whatever he could to enrich himself, and surrounded himself with young men who were of a similar ilk. We do not know why, but Belshazzar appears to have been the leader of this coup to kill Labashi-Marduk and to put someone else on the throne. But for some reason, Nabonidus seems to have been the only person who could do that successfully, take the position on the throne. So although Nabonidus was not really a key player in this coup, and although his son Belshazzar was a key player in this coup, it's Nabonidus that ended up being the king, and Belshazzar is only able to rise to that position when his father takes off to Tema 3 years after he came to power. We do see when Belshazzar comes to power, the historians say that it is quite clear that you see a change in the way that Babylon is administered, and that Belshazzar makes moves to benefit himself personally, and he makes every move he can make to pull that off, to benefit himself personally and his friends around him. Nabonidus didn't do that. In 539, then, the Medes and the Persians are able to take control, they're able to conquer Babylon and take control, and then they set up their own empire to replace the Babylonian Empire. I'll tell you just a little bit about the events that surrounded that. The Medes had been allies of the Persians when they fought against the Assyrians, if you remember back, that the Babylonian, well, it was Nebuchadnezzar's father, Nabopolassar, who had allied himself with the Medes and the Scythians in an effort to overthrow Assyrian power. So Babylon had been allies with the Medes at that point in time. And as I pointed out earlier, Nabopolassar married his son, Nebuchadnezzar, to the princess of the Median Empire, Median Kingdom. And so there was a tight alliance that was formed between the Medes and the Babylonians at that point in time. I don't know when that alliance fell apart, but it was certainly gone by the time that Nebuchadnezzar died, or soon after Nebuchadnezzar died. So the other kings, the successors to Nebuchadnezzar, didn't have that same kind of allegiance or closeness with the Medes. And as a result, the Medes drift off. They develop separately, develop their own interests, and some of those interests come into conflict with the interests of Babylon. As a result, the Medes end up becoming closely allied with another group of people, another people group in the highlands of Iran, and those are the Persians. So the Medes and the Persians become closely united. That unification is brought about by Cyrus. Cyrus became the king of Persia when his father died in 559. And then he incorporated Media in 549, 10 years later. So Cyrus is the key player in that. He's the one who was able to bring those two kingdoms together and he brought them together so closely that they remained together for certainly decades, if not centuries. Cyrus also went on to lead the Medes and Persians in the conquest of Lydia. Lydia would have been in what is now Turkey, and it was a large kingdom right in the heart of present-day Turkey. He did that in 546. So the Medes and the Persians put together a very large empire just to the north of Babylon. And then they start marching towards Babylon. When they start moving towards Babylon, that's when Nabonidus returns from Tema to Babylon to defend Babylon against the Medes and the Persians. And Nabonidus put together a Babylonian army, and he had had one in Tema, but he joins that with armies from Babylon proper. And they go out to fight against the Medes and the Persians as the Medes and Persians are getting closer to Babylon. Nabonidus tried to stop Cyrus at Sippar, but there was a battle there, and Nabonidus and his army were routed. And Nabonidus fled the battleground and took refuge in a nearby Babylonian city. Cyrus then just continued his march towards Babylon, having already defeated the main Babylonian army. So what was happening at the time of the feast described in chapter 5? We'll read about it in just a minute, but there was a big feast that Belshazzar was holding in Babylon, in the city of Babylon. Well, the main Babylonian army led by Nabonidus has already been defeated, and Belshazzar has to have known that at this point in time. And probably knows that Nabonidus had gone into hiding in one of the Babylonian cities, and so was not going to be of much assistance, at least in the short run. So Belshazzar is hiding. He's in Babylon, just waiting for the Medes and the Persians to besiege the city. But it was thought that the city of Babylon was absolutely impregnable. Nebuchadnezzar had spent a lot of time building defensive walls around the city to protect it from any kind of invasion, to make it siege-proof. So Belshazzar is probably, on the one hand, a little bit nervous, but on the other hand, is feeling pretty confident that Babylon can survive this siege, and that Babylon over time will be able to put together a counter force that will be able to deal with the Medo-Persian military threat. So that's the situation when we get into chapter 5 of the book of Daniel. I'll read the first four verses. King Belshazzar gave a great banquet for 1,000 of his nobles and drank wine with them. While Belshazzar was drinking his wine, he gave orders to bring in the gold and silver goblets that Nebuchadnezzar, his father, had taken from the temple in Jerusalem, so that the king and his nobles, his wives, and his concubines might drink from them. So they brought in the gold goblets that had been taken from the temple of God in Jerusalem, and the king and his nobles, his wives, and his concubines drank from them. As they drank the wine, they praised the gods of gold and silver, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone. So Belshazzar is in Babylon. They're waiting to see what the Medo-Persian army is going to do. The great feast, they think it was held in the big hall in the palace in Babylon. Apparently that has been found archaeologically. They even know the dimensions of this room, which, as I understand, it was about 50 feet by 150 feet, which means with 1,000 nobles in there, it's packed, absolutely packed. There, it's not entirely clear what they're thinking. Like I said, they know the Persians are coming, but they may have felt very secure because they're surrounded by these multiple city walls, layers of city walls. So they may have been feeling very secure, but they may have chosen to celebrate in the face of whatever risk of danger they were running. And this could have been a celebration that was kind of a propaganda act, showing their confidence in the security despite the threat that was out there. So it's not entirely clear to me to what degree they felt secure and to what degree they were scared. But they were certainly putting on a front that things were fine and they are just having a big party. There's emphasis on the fact, on making it clear that they were drinking wine. So what happens, what follows after this, seems to all be related to the fact that they have been drinking a lot of wine. So they're at least tipsy, if not drunk, when these things happen. It's in this state of some degree of inebriation that Belshazzar calls for the vessels from the temple in Jerusalem to be brought in, gold and silver vessels. Now, as you'll recall, these vessels have a history. If you remember back in, it's talked about in Isaiah as well as 2 Kings, that years before Babylon conquered Jerusalem, some Babylonian emissaries came from Babylon to Jerusalem to talk to King Hezekiah. And it would appear that the topic of discussion was, did Judah want to form an alliance with Babylon against the Assyrians? Because this was during the period of time when the Assyrians were still dominant in the region, had a large empire. And we know that the Babylonians had been fighting for quite a while to try to free themselves from Assyrian control. So representatives from Babylon came to Jerusalem, and Hezekiah took them to the temple. There are these storehouses that surrounded the temple building. And those were just full of all kinds of items that were used in the service, as well as other valuable items were all stored in these storerooms. And they showed the Babylonian representatives all their wealth, including these vessels. So these vessels are mentioned way back then. Then in 605, when the Babylonians first come against Jerusalem and tribute is paid and hostages are taken, and that's when Daniel is taken, the vessels are taken at that time. And I've pointed out before, I really think the vessels come to be symbolic of, I guess I'll call it, the spirit of God in God's people, that those vessels get taken to Babylon, and that's symbolic of the whole nation of Israel being taken into exile. And then they return after Cyrus announces that the people of Judah can return to Jerusalem. That first group that goes back, they take the vessels, and that's recorded in the book of Ezra. So they were there 70 years. They were there for that. It's kind of symbolic of the exile that was inflicted on the people of Judah. Why would Belshazzar have asked for these particular goblets? They probably had items from every group of people that they had conquered, I would think. I mean, I don't know that for sure, but I would think they would. Why would these items be called for? Now, it could be pure happenstance. He just told them, go get some goblets out of our storehouses where we've got the stuff that we've taken from other countries. So it could have been just pure happenstance. I don't think that's the case. It looks to me from the text that we are to understand that there was an act of dishonoring towards God, and I think an active act of dishonoring towards Yahweh that is taking place here. So it could be that this is driven by anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism seems to have been a phenomenon that has existed throughout the ages. And I think we see hints of anti-Semitism even in the book of Daniel. So it could be just anti-Semitism, that Belshazzar doesn't like the Jews and therefore asks specifically for those vessels to be brought. It seems to be it's also possible that Belshazzar understands that the God of the Jews, that is Yahweh, is the only God of all the peoples that they've encountered. Yahweh is the only God that requires exclusive worship and the only God that has no idols. And because of the emphasis in this passage on praising idols, I'm a little suspicious that that might be at least part of what's going on here. Now, it could be anti-Semitism and this singling out the God of the Jews for disrespect. I'm not sure. But it's very clear from the text that this, whatever Belshazzar is thinking about this, whatever his motivations are, it is intentionally dishonoring to Yahweh. The text goes on to say then that they honored the various idols. This is an interesting little tidbit. We know historically that when Nabonidus came back from Tema to Babylon, one of the things, and he's anticipating an assault by the Medes and the Persians, one of the first things that he does, he goes around to the cities surrounding Babylon, and he takes their idols to Babylon for safekeeping. Because apparently, well, let me read what Beaulieu says. The events connected with the downfall of the empire in the 17th year are better known, since the entry of the chronicle for this year is almost entirely preserved. So it's that fact that is really helpful. We've got good information about this last year of the Babylonian Empire. The New Year's festival was celebrated and offerings given to all the temples of the kingdom. The next event reported is the gathering of the divine statues of the sanctuaries of Babylonia in the capital. If this reconstruction is correct, it would mean that Nabonidus expected a Persian invasion and was making preparations accordingly several months before the clash of arms at Opus. Clearly, Nabonidus wanted to prevent the statues from falling into the hands of the enemy. Carrying off divine images was a common punishment imposed on vanquished peoples in the ancient Near East. And it seems reasonable to assume that Nabonidus was trying to ensure the loyalty of all Babylonian cities by sheltering their main gods in the capital, which could endure a long siege. So the thinking is that he did this. He brought in all of the idols from the cities surrounding Babylon to protect them from any conquering that the Medes and the Persian might accomplish. So at this feast, they're honoring all the idols of Babylon. And at the same time, they're calling in the vessels, the goblets dedicated to Yahweh, and drinking from them. And it's thought maybe these were libations for the idols that were being made using the goblets from the temple. Clearly, he's dishonoring the one true God, the God of Judah. And it's because of that that the next thing occurs. Verses 5 through 9. Suddenly, the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall near the lampstand in the royal palace. The king watched the hand as it wrote. His face turned pale, and he was so frightened that his knees knocked together and his legs gave way. The king called out for the enchanters, astrologers, and diviners to be brought. and said to these wise men of Babylon, whoever reads this writing and tells what it means will be clothed in purple and have a gold chain placed around his neck, and he will be made the third highest ruler in the kingdom. Then all the king's wise men came in, but they could not read the writing or tell the king what it meant. So King Belshazzar became even more terrified, and his face grew more pale. His nobles were baffled. So God makes himself known to Belshazzar, and in an interesting way, a hand, a human hand, and in the Greek text, it would appear that it's just the fingers that are visible. A human hand comes and starts writing on the wall. Apparently, it's the wall opposite where Belshazzar is sitting. Belshazzar is sitting on the, it would be the east side of the hall, and that's the long side. And it's on the opposite side. And archaeologically, it's highly likely that this was a stone building, but plastered on the inside. So it's a plastered wall that's opposite him. So these fingers are appearing, and they're writing something on this plastered wall, white plastered wall. So we've got a human hand writing words. So God has condescended to make his thoughts known to human beings through human language with a human hand writing these words. The hand then disappears. Once these are written, the hand disappears, but the writing remains. So Belshazzar, he's scared to death. He's physically affected by what he has seen. And he does what Babylonian rulers do. They call in all the wise men to make sense of what he has just witnessed. And not just him alone. There are 1,000 people in that room, nobles who saw this as well. So he calls in the Chaldeans, the wise men, to interpret what's written on the wall, the graffiti on the wall. And he offers a prize to anyone who can do it. It's wealth and power that he's offering in exchange for an interpretation of what's on the wall. In fact, he will make that person third in power. And there's a phrase that gave people fits. And for a long time, they couldn't figure out what this phrase meant. But when it was determined that Nabonidus was the king, but he was absent, Belshazzar was the king for all intents and purposes in Babylon. So we kind of have two kings. Then what's being offered is the third person, the third position in the empire. Okay. So they come in and they look at what's on the wall and they can't make sense of it. They're unable to read it or interpret the inscription. And this made Belshazzar and the nobles even more alarmed. Now, there's lots of speculation about why they couldn't understand it. Maybe it was written in another alphabet, other characters. There's a lot of speculation about that. I have no idea. I don't know why they couldn't read it. The only thing that I can think of is sometimes when I go to a website, I'll see they'll show you a little patch of some scribbling, and you're supposed to write down what letters are depicted there. And half the time I can't figure it out. So I suspect that's what happened. That God wrote in that kind of scribbling and wise men couldn't figure out what it was. Verses 10 through 12, the queen, hearing the voices of the king and his nobles, came into the banquet hall. O king, live forever, she said. Don't be alarmed. Don't look so pale. There is a man in your kingdom who has the spirit of the holy gods in him. In the time of your father, he was found to have insight and intelligence and wisdom like that of the gods. King Nebuchadnezzar, your father, the king, I say, appointed him chief of the magicians, enchanters, astrologers, and diviners. This man, Daniel, whom the king called Belshazzar, was found to have a keen mind and knowledge and understanding, and also the ability to interpret dreams, explain riddles, and solve difficult problems. Call for Daniel, and he will tell you what the writing means. So the queen mother comes in. And so this is not necessarily, this isn't Belshazzar's wife, but rather this is Belshazzar's mother. And the queen mother was a very respected position in the ancient world in general, but that is true of Babylon as well. So she comes in, and it's interesting, she comes into the presence of the king without being invited, which would have been unheard of for any woman to come into his presence without being invited. There's no indication of an invitation. She just comes in, and because she's heard the uproar, she's heard things, the sounds from the banquet hall, she comes in, she says, "O king, live forever. Don't worry. You don't have to be scared and bothered. There is someone here who can make sense of what's written on the wall." Now, she was, as I mentioned before, as best as we can piece things together, she was the daughter of Nebuchadnezzar. She probably knew Daniel personally, certainly knew about Daniel personally. And she also knew Nebuchadnezzar personally and knew Nebuchadnezzar's all the things that happened to Nebuchadnezzar, certainly the period of time when he was out grazing in the grass in the pastures. So she knows all of that. And she assures Belshazzar that this is a mystery that can be solved because you have a resource in your midst that can solve that, and that is Daniel. He is one who has the spirit of the holy gods, which is the same phrase that Nebuchadnezzar had used in talking about Daniel. She says that Nebuchadnezzar had found him to be wise and insightful. And Nebuchadnezzar had made him a chief of the Chaldeans because of his wisdom and his ability to interpret these mysteries. And she says his name is Daniel. So she says, call him and he will interpret it. Belshazzar does what his mother recommended. Verse 13. So Daniel was brought before the king, and the king said to him, "Are you Daniel, one of the exiles my father the king brought from Judah? I have heard that the spirit of the gods is in you, and that you have insight, intelligence, and outstanding wisdom. The wise men and enchanters were brought before me to read this writing and tell me what it means, but they could not explain it. Now I have heard that you are able to give interpretations and to solve difficult problems. If you can read this writing and tell me what it means, you will be clothed in purple and have a gold chain placed around your neck, and you'll be made the third highest ruler in the kingdom." It would appear, given this piece of text, that Daniel is still around, but he's apparently in retirement. It doesn't sound like he is a leading official. If he's still working in the governmental apparatus, he's apparently in the background, because Belshazzar doesn't seem to have a personal relationship with Daniel. That's on the one hand. But on the other hand, he seems to have heard some stories about Daniel or something, because he knows more than the queen mentioned. He knows that he's an exile brought from Judah by Nebuchadnezzar. So he knows something about Daniel. Daniel comes and appears before the king, and Belshazzar says, Are you the Daniel that Nebuchadnezzar brought from Judah?" And it's interesting, he says, "An exile, are you the exile from Judah that Nebuchadnezzar brought here?" Kind of underscoring the fact that Daniel is just a captive taken from one of the lands that Nebuchadnezzar had conquered. And yet, he knows the stories that he has the spirit of the gods in him, and the wise men were unable to decipher it, but maybe Daniel can do this. And if he can, he'll get the reward that Belshazzar had mentioned previously, including being in the third position in the empire. Verses 17 through 21. Then Daniel answered the king, "You may keep your gifts for yourself and give your rewards to someone else. Nevertheless, I will read the writing for the king and tell him what it means. O king, the Most High God gave your father Nebuchadnezzar sovereignty and greatness and glory and splendor. Because of the high position he gave him, all the peoples and nations and men of every language dreaded and feared him. Those the king wanted to put to death, he put to death. Those he wanted to spare, he spared. Those he wanted to promote, he promoted. And those he wanted to humble, he humbled. But when his heart became arrogant and hardened with pride, he was deposed from his royal throne and stripped of his glory. He was driven away from people and given the mind of an animal. He lived with the wild donkeys and ate grass like cattle. And his body was drenched with the dew of heaven until he acknowledged that the Most High God is sovereign over the kingdoms of men and sets over them anyone he wishes." So first of all, Daniel turns down the reward and says, "You can give it to somebody else, but I'll interpret the writing." Then Daniel goes through a brief recounting of the events surrounding Nebuchadnezzar's humbling by God. He talks about Nebuchadnezzar having all this power that God had given him, but he became arrogant, saw it as his own power, inherently his own power. And so God humbled him by causing him to go live like an animal for a period of time until he responded to God. And therefore, we know that God is the one who decides who rules and who does not, which is a rather pointed message to Belshazzar. So it's clear that what Daniel is saying to Belshazzar is, just like with Nebuchadnezzar, your power is a gift from God. You wouldn't have it if God didn't grant it to you. Verses 22 through 24. "But you, his son, O Belshazzar, have not humbled yourself, though you knew all this. Instead, you have set yourself up against the Lord of heaven. You have the goblets from his temple brought to you, and you and your nobles, your wives, and your concubines drank wine from them. You praise the gods of silver and gold, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which cannot see or hear or understand. But you did not honor the God who holds in his hand your life and all your ways. Therefore, he sent the hand that wrote the inscription." So Belshazzar didn't learn from his grandfather's experience. Clearly, he had to have known. The stories must have been passed down, because Daniel expects Belshazzar to have been able to learn from that experience. "So you exalted yourself over the sovereign God and treated with disrespect his holy vessels. And then you praised the idols instead of the God of the universe, the creator God." Okay, so that's why God sent that message. That's why God wrote that message on the wall. Verses 25 through 29. "This is the inscription that was written, many, many tekel upharsin. This is what these words mean. Many means God has numbered the days of your reign and brought it to an end. Tekel, you have been weighed on the scales and found wanting. And Peres, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians." Then at Belshazzar's command, Daniel was clothed in purple, a gold chain was placed around his neck, and he was proclaimed the third highest ruler in the kingdom. The message that was written on the wall consists of three words, Aramaic words. Interestingly, as best I understand it, each of these three words has two different meanings. The common meaning for each one designates some kind of measure. So I've come up with something that would be similar to what in English, that would be similar to what was written on the wall. So it's something like pound, pound, ounce, quarter. Or maybe something even better would be pound, pound, half, quarter. There's no clear meaning. It's not immediately obvious how these can be put together into a coherent idea. But they all have something to do with measurement or value. But Daniel, when he interprets it, he uses another meaning for each word. Each of these words can also be understood as a verb. And it's the verbal meaning that he draws upon when Daniel does the interpretation. So it's something, instead of pound, pound, half, or quarter, it's something like counted, counted, weighed, and divided. Now so there's a play on words that's going on, and I tried to capture that in my English equivalent that I put, pound, pound, half, and quarter. If you hear pound and half and quarter, you're thinking along certain lines as to what would be the meaning of these words, that it's parts of things, it's a measurement. But each of those words, even that I picked these because they're words that have to do with measurement, but they also can be understood as verbs. So pound, as in go pound sand, half, as in divide into pieces, and quarter, as in put somebody up, house someone, to quarter. So it's a similar phenomenon then that you have in the Aramaic that was written on the wall, that Daniel, instead of going with the noun meanings of these three words, which would have been the natural direction to go, he goes with the verbal meaning of these words and puts together an understanding of what is intended. And these three words in Aramaic have the benefit of the last word in the set sounding like the word for Persian. So Daniel uses the less likely meanings for these words, and he's able to put this into a meaningful sentence. And it's a prediction that because the Babylonian Empire was found wanting by God, it was going to be given over to the Persians. Not a favorable proclamation, but Belshazzar doesn't seem to be devastated by it. I'm not sure why not. He immediately gives him the reward that he had promised. The fact that Babylonian Empire isn't going to be around very long makes this reward kind of meaningless, but nevertheless, he gives it over. I don't know why Daniel accepted it. Earlier, he had said that he wouldn't accept it. I don't know if he just decided he'd go through the motions or exactly what was going through his mind, but he apparently accepts the reward that had been offered. We don't really know how Belshazzar responded to this, other than he just goes on, he gives the reward that he had promised. There's no other indication of how he responded to it. My suspicion is that he didn't take it seriously. Because I think if he had taken it seriously, he would have responded with repentance. We see no suggestion of that. Furthermore, there is no suggestion of how the 1,000 nobles that were present took it. And this would all be significant for them as well. If the Babylonian Empire is on the verge of ceasing to exist, that's going to have a huge impact on their lives. But no indication of how they responded. Two more verses. That very night, Belshazzar, king of the Babylonians, was slain, and Darius the Mede took over the kingdom at the age of 62. So Belshazzar was killed that very night. He died. He was put to death. The Persians came. They overran the city of Babylon, and Belshazzar was killed. Now we get some information about this that fills in, so we can understand better what was happening. We get some information from the Greek historian Xenophon. He wrote about this incident. There was a man by the name of Gobryas. Gobryas was a Babylonian. And a few years prior to this event, Gobryas had been a high-ranking official in the Babylonian government. And Gobryas's son was singled out by Belshazzar and killed. And it's not clear why Belshazzar killed him, but Belshazzar had Gobryas's son killed. Gobryas was outraged, and he fled Babylon and went to the Persians. And he offered his services then to Cyrus, the king of the Persians. So when the Persians are invading the Babylonian Empire, Gobryas is made a high-ranking military officer. And apparently the operation of taking Babylon was put into his hands because he intimately knew the city of Babylon. And he probably knew all of the weaknesses, and he exploited the weaknesses. According to Xenophon, the way that the Babylonians took, the way that the Persians took Babylon was they diverted the river that runs right, it runs under the walls of Babylon and then flows out at the other end. And as I understand it, there was a big metal grate where the river went under the walls. But that metal grate didn't go all the way down to the ground. It just went down to the water. So what Gobryas did was he had the Persian army divert the river. And once the river was diverted, then the Persian army could just march into the city of Babylon on the riverbed underneath the grate. They come up inside the city and quickly take the city with very little opposition. So apparently then, Gobryas, who has a personal grievance against Belshazzar, hunts down Belshazzar and kills him. There is some indication that the Babylonians actually celebrated the Persians' conquest. And we don't know exactly why. We don't know exactly what was going on. There is some suggestion that Nabonidus, who, as you'll recall, I said was very pious, but he primarily worshipped the moon god. And in Temna, the moon god was the main god. But in Babylon, the main god is Marduk. And by worshiping the moon god as the main god, Nabonidus alienated the priesthood of the god Marduk in Babylon. And apparently there were a lot of people in Babylon that were outraged by Nabonidus's neglect of Marduk. And therefore, there was a lot of social discontent in Babylon. And the Persians capitalize on that. They come in and they face no significant opposition. In fact, they're welcomed because this bad rule that they have been subjugated to is being removed. So Babylon and then the whole empire is taken over by the Medes and the Persians. And it says, Darius the Mede took over the kingdom at the age of 62. This is Darius the Mede. I will argue next week that Cyrus the Persian is the same person as Darius the Mede. That's the same person. And that's been a difficult question by historians to try to sort out the difference between the two. But I think Weissman is right, and he says that they are the same. We'll talk about that more next week. Okay, it is under Darius then, and it's just a year later, that Jews are allowed to go back to Jerusalem, to rebuild Jerusalem and to rebuild the temple. And when they go, they take the vessels with them, the temple vessels with them. So the vessels leave with the people, symbolic of them going back to, and God's presence going back to Jerusalem. Okay, there are just a few things that I want to comment on. The first one is, notice how differently Belshazzar gets treated by God from how Nebuchadnezzar gets treated. And by Daniel as well. Daniel showed affection for Nebuchadnezzar. It seems to me that Daniel genuinely liked Nebuchadnezzar. There is no sign of affection between Daniel and Belshazzar. Daniel is very matter of fact. And what's going to happen is going to happen. And Daniel doesn't see it as a tragedy that Belshazzar is going to be removed. From Yahweh, notice that Belshazzar doesn't get three chances like Nebuchadnezzar did. Belshazzar gets one chance. Belshazzar doesn't have the character. He doesn't have the tenderness of heart that you see in Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar is an emperor. He can be brutal and cruel. He can be impetuous. But there's a tender-heartedness to him, it seems to me. And because of that, God deals more patiently with him and is willing to interact over a longer period of time, and to even subject Nebuchadnezzar to a miserable experience of going crazy for an extended period of time. Because I think God cares about Nebuchadnezzar and wants him to come around. There are a number of inscriptions written by Nebuchadnezzar during the time of Nebuchadnezzar that I think are fascinating. And here's a quote from Weissman, who wrote a book about Nebuchadnezzar. And this quote includes two inscriptions by Nebuchadnezzar when Nebuchadnezzar was alive. I'll read this. The strong used to plunder the weak. And this is a quote. This is the inscription that Nebuchadnezzar had written. The strong used to plunder the weak, who was not equal to a lawsuit. The rich used to take the property of the poor. Regent and prince would not take the part of the cripple and the widow before the judge. And if they came before the judge, he would not preside over their case. Even if the judge took a bribe or present, he would pay no attention to it, that is, to the case, if they did not accept any decision from him. So that's one inscription, or at least part of an inscription. And then in contrast, Nebuchadnezzar claims that, and there's another inscription, he was not negligent in the matter of true and righteous judgment. He did not rest night or day, but with counsel and deliberation, he persisted in writing down judgment and decisions arranged to be pleasing to the great Lord Marduk, and for the betterment of all the peoples, and the settling of the land for the betterment of all the peoples, and the settling of the land of Babylonia. He drew up improved regulations for the city and rebuilt the law courts. It's just interesting to see the emphasis that Nebuchadnezzar placed on justice taking care of the poor. And that apparently predates him going crazy. So there's a tender-heartedness in Nebuchadnezzar, I think, that is apparent and makes sense of why God worked with Nebuchadnezzar over an extended period of time to get him to come around. There is no indication that Belshazzar shared his grandfather's interests, and there's no indication that God spends the kind of time working on him the way he worked on Nebuchadnezzar. It is interesting to me that God spoke differently to Nebuchadnezzar than he did to Belshazzar. To Nebuchadnezzar, he appeared in dreams that only Nebuchadnezzar saw. Now, those were interpreted, and I'm sure some people heard the interpretation, but he's the only one that saw the visions. With Belshazzar, there is a hand that writes words on a wall that Belshazzar sees, but 1,000 nobles also see it. It's very public. It's a public, wondrous act that God performs. Exactly why God does that, I'm not sure. I'm not sure why God does that, but that it's interesting to me that he chose those two different means. And then, as I've pointed out, the vessels of the temple apparently represent God's presence. They go into exile with the people of Israel. They come out of exile with the people of Israel. They are abused by the Babylonians along with the people of Israel. They seem to symbolize God's presence. And there's an interesting passage in Isaiah chapter 52 that refers to these vessels in an interesting way. I'm just going to read it because getting into talking about what it means and stuff would take too long. But I just think it's a fascinating allusion to these vessels. So I'll read a few verses out of Isaiah 52. Isaiah says, and this was written during the period of time when the Assyrians were strong. The Babylonian Empire hasn't come into being yet. And yet, these are the words that are written, and they obviously have significance for the people who bring good news, who proclaim peace, who bring good tidings, who proclaim salvation, who say to Zion, your God reigns. Listen, your watchmen lift up their voices. Together they shout for joy. When the Lord returns to Zion, they will see it with their own eyes, burst into songs of joy together, you ruins of Jerusalem. For the Lord has comforted his people. He has redeemed Jerusalem. The Lord will lay bare his holy arm in the sight of all the nations, and all the ends of the earth will see the salvation of our God. Depart, depart, go out from there. Touch no unclean thing. Come out from it and be pure, you who carry the vessels of the Lord. But you will not leave in haste or go in flight, for the Lord will go before you. The God of Israel will be your rear guard. Okay, those are my comments. We've got a little bit of time for questions. Margaret asks, did Nebuchadnezzar have both a son and a grandson named Belshazzar? I'm not sure why you're asking that, unless you're getting it from the wording that you find in the text where it refers to Nebuchadnezzar as the father of Belshazzar. And I should have mentioned this. The word father in Hebrew is a more flexible term than it is in English, both father and son. Father can mean what we would mean by father, but it can also mean any direct ancestor, any male direct ancestor, so the male line. So it can mean either father, it could mean grandfather, it could mean great-grandfather, it could mean great-great-grandfather, etc. So it can mean any of those things. Son, likewise, can mean son, literally, the way we use the term, or it can mean grandson, or it can mean great-grandson, or great-great-grandson, etc. So when the Queen Mother comes in and says, your father, Nebuchadnezzar, that doesn't necessarily mean that Nebuchadnezzar was the father. It could mean grandfather. And so that seems to make the most sense, that Belshazzar was the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar. Okay, so next week we'll look at chapter 6 of Daniel, and chapter 6 will kind of bring an end to the kind of narrative that we have seen so far. After chapter 6, the style of the presentation changes a bit, and we'll get to that. Thank you very much for your attention. We'll see you next week. Bye.